in our supervisory management training programs after I left IVS and started working for AID.
Oh, okay.
Supervisory management is such that people have to change and take risks as managers.
Okay.
Now, did I mean when I answered that question when I was working with Lau as an IVS person, did that happen? I can't say that it did.
Okay.
Because as an IVS person, as a volunteer, I didn't work with any people other than technical people, and we didn't talk about such things as taking risks and management then.
No, that would have been a little bit different.
Right. And as a team leader and associate chief of party, my jobs were mostly managing the IVS program, not teaching Lau to do anything differently.
Right. Yeah.
So that comment, I would, for some reason, I guess I thought that the questions were oriented toward maybe longer-term impacts.
Well, yeah,
based
on
IBS experience, but applied later.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That would have been something that, because of my IBS experience working with Lau at the low and medium level.
Right.
I was able to apply that in the work I did for AID as we devised these programs, these training programs for
Lau.
Okay,
that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
All right. That does clarify, because I was wondering, you know,
how could I have
Lau
done
taking
that?
Lau taking risks?
Yeah.
I want to hear about this one. You know, I want to see what the magic potion was for that sort of thing. But
as we ran those supervisory management programs,
okay,
that does imply taking risks as managers and making decisions,
correct,
doing different things. If you're trying to bring people in traditional society into a more modern society, people have to take risks.
Yes,
and that's what we built into our management training programs and laws.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go
did
ahead.
They, just out of curiosity,
sure,
did they respond well?
Oh, yeah, very well.
Okay.
Very well. We had really, really excellent participation in these management training programs.
So as soon as you took the cultural context away that required not taking risks, then people responded very positively to taking
risks.
Well,
we had to put it in the cultural context, though.
Yeah, a new cultural
context, for
example, of risk-taking plus reward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. I still remember some of the training sessions we had where I asked them, you know, you're at home and you have one set of social values where getting along with people is more important than achievement, for example. You come in the gate to work in the morning working for AID, and AID has a totally different set of values, where achievement is important and you get paid for and rewarded for what you achieve. What do you do when you walk through that gate? Do you have a button that you push?
Uh-huh.
And we had some very good discussions as a result.
Well, I'm sure
of that.
You could.
Yeah.
Yeah, some real introspective sort of discussions and
right.
and analyses, yeah. Yeah.
And some of the discussion periods that we had in this English section, we were like that too, where we wanted to select topics for discussion, English language discussion.
Right, right.
Which would spark a lot of interest so that they'd want to speak and learn how new words and learn how to mix, put the new words together. One of those discussion topics was the question of dowry for
Yeah, you made a mention
women.
Of that. I thought that was in relation to your own marriage.
No, not at all. I didn't have to do that in my marriage.
Okay.
But the dowry question had a real good discussion as to whether in this new era that they were going into, should women, should there have to be a dowry in right. order to pay for the women? And surprisingly, the girls were very supportive of it, because it was sort of a sense of their value there, yeah, to their okay. families was that there would be a dowry paid. Uh-huh, But then you got the discussion, well, do you marry for the income for your family or for love, sort of a thing, you know, and in this traditional arranged marriage society, you know, which was already very much influenced by Western society. And finally, they concluded that there must be a dowry, even if it's only one kip. One kip will do. Just the principle of the thing.
For the principle.
For
okay.
the principle. That there's some value there. That the boy has to give up something. Or the boy's family has to give up something. In principle.
It's almost like the dollar a year man who will serve, you know, the rich guy who will serve for a dollar a year and just to make it legal and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's cute. Okay. But that did clarify the one thing. Now, you said that there were some strains in the IVS-AID relationship.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well, when our people were going to be employed to work in the rural areas, those areas were not totally safe. These were
so
the forward
security,
areas.
Security.
Mostly security problems.
Okay.
And at one point, there was a landmine blew up a truck within eyesight distance of the house where our IVS volunteers were working. And there had already been an understanding with the AID person in charge of that area that if our volunteers felt physically threatened, that they wouldn't have to stay. And when that landmine blew up the truck, they felt physically threatened. They say, sorry, we don't feel like we want to live here anymore.
Yeah.
So they came into town. Well, that really stirred up the AID leadership, because they had contracted with IVS to put these people out there no matter what the conditions were. According to them. That wasn't, of course, what the arrangement was on the ground. So we had some real tense moments there. And that led to an AID decision to bring in their own employees to work in those rural areas, rather than depend on the NGO, the IVS volunteers.
You mean to substitute for them and eliminate the IVS, or to
work? Well, they decided to keep the IVS volunteers too, but they were going to depend for the rural presence on direct AID employees rather than.
So they were sharing the same spot, you mean to say?
How did
that the team became expanded by one or two with. One or two being AID, as opposed to...
What did happen was that AID brought in their direct hire employees to live physically in those areas.
Along with IVS?
Along with the IVS volunteers.
Okay.
But if the IVS volunteers felt physically threatened, they weren't going to stay there. And there were a couple of areas where AID had their people out there and IVS didn't.
Whose call was that? The individual volunteers, or did you as... either team leader
and
then later associate?
While I was there, it hadn't developed to what happened. They hadn't brought in the direct hire employees yet during my time as an IVS volunteer.
As a team, as an associate chief of party. Okay.
They made the decision while I was associate chief of party, but it was only implemented later.
Okay.
Much later, actually.
Yeah.
And our IVS volunteers stayed there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Why do I get the impression it was much later? No, it wasn't that much later, actually. It because we had one of those people in our in Sayabri one before I had left after the first year.
One of the direct hires.
One of the direct hires.
Okay.
And the real problem came up later than that, when the person in charge had said, okay, we were in a provincial capital in Sayabri.
Right.
The team and the AID direct hire came in after we had become established. And in the Vientiane province, they were putting people out in more remote locations than the capital city. That was the issue. So they determined that they were going to hire more direct hire people to go out in the rural areas instead of just being chiefs of the province during the time I was associate chief of party.
Yeah, when you said they were sending out people, they, AID, were sending out
they
which people?
They decided to staff the rural areas with their own direct hire people.
Okay, all right.
And not just depend on the IVS people in these remote locations.
All right, okay. Yeah, that would have...
But because they couldn't hire that many, and there were plenty of remote locations that they wanted to place people, the two systems worked together.
Yeah, I can imagine getting back to just a step or half step back, how the exploding truck would certainly make me a little nervous. Because I was in a assignment where the this in the Philippines, where the new People's Army moved in, and told me to leave, which of course I did. But then was able to work out a kind of modus vivendi where we were able to coexist in the same barrio. But I was very careful to, you know, just wave, say hello, you know. A few things like that, and make sure that I was never associated with any information that got back to military sources.
Yeah.
You know, not only for my own sake, but for my friends. This is a very difficult situation to work out.
Can't be seen as a spy, that's for sure.
No, because you won't be seen long.
That's right. You know?
And for good reason. I mean, if I was them, I wouldn't want me. But... But I'm a little bit curious about the it's obviously a miscommunication that led to the brouhaha after the IVS individual said, nope, we're out of here. How did the upper ranks miss this call? That, you know, what was the difference between the agreement that was reached out at the upper level and then the ground level?
It was an evolving situation there. And I guess in the early stages where the decision was made to bring in the Varda team, it was acceptable to everybody that these people would be out there doing development type work.
Right.
But that the element of risk must not have come up too much. I wasn't there in those days, so I don't know how it... I don't know if Bob Ziegler... Have you talked with him yet?
The other night, I didn't... But I didn't know about this.
Well, he was our chief of party when I first arrived. So he was there when the whole...
When the Varda decision was made.
Varda... Actually, he was there after the decision was made, but he was there as the initial person to get Varda going.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. And the situation wasn't quite as tense politically. I don't think there were that many threats. There wasn't that much terrorism at the beginning.
Right.
So as the situation evolved over time, and the threats came closer to home.
Particularly after 60.
Nobody consciously had dealt with that issue.
All right.
Except that at the ground level they had to. But at the upper level they hadn't had to face that issue.
So this is a controversy that erupts because of an evolving situation.
Right, right.
Rather than some disconnect between lower level and upper level.
Yes.
It's just the situation
arising. Well, the disconnect was there because I'm sure the upper level would have had to have considered the situation too. But it may be a shades of gray in this particular incident.
Right.
A shades of gray type of a question where the upper level felt that wasn't serious enough because mm-hmm. it wasn't directly against a volunteer. Why would a volunteer think that his life was in danger if that was not targeted to the volunteer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a direct personal threat.
That's right. So why don't the volunteers just stay there? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, these two individuals felt that they weren't paid enough to risk their lives on that same road where they drive also, even though they're not targeted.
I think I can empathize a little
right.
bit with that myself.
Yeah.
You know?
and they just decided that their lives weren't
with that person's agenda.
That's right.
Yeah. Again, I can empathize with that. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, that does clarify, just, you know, because
sure.
you mentioned that there were sometimes tensions.
Yeah.
But that's the point of the oral interview.
Right.
To find out an example of that. Does that in somehow relate to the circumstances of the one Hmong co-worker that you had and his death? There was a mention.
He was one of the people that worked in the Sing Quang team.
Oh, this is quite earlier then.
It was earlier. Yeah. He died. He died fairly early in the conflict. He was one of Pop Buell's really important people.
Even though Buell had only been there a few months.
No, we're talking about he died much later than when we were both volunteers.
Oh, I see.
But he came out of the IBS.
Sing Quang.
Yeah, Sing Quang
experience.
Team, yeah.
Oh, okay, I see. Okay. Well, what were the circumstances there of his death?
Apparently, he was being used by the Hmong as a scout into enemy territory. And he just simply, he did his job for quite a good period of time and did it very well, very effectively, but one day he caught up.
Yeah,
that's
caught
right.
up with him. Okay, I thought it was somehow to do with IVS work in the field,
as if he was an interpreter or
a counterpart employee of some sort.
I don't think he was a direct IVS employee at that time.
Or even a counterpart,
co-worker
sort of thing. Okay, I wasn't sure, and again, I wanted to clarify that point.
I don't know if you'd if Paul White's on your list. I don't know where he is these days, but he was working with Pop Buell, but he was an IBS volunteer in the Sing Quang area during the very critical period here in the
Paul White,
yeah. In
the
early 70s, he was an IBS volunteer.
Well, he's on the list, but unfortunately he lives in Tokyo.
Yeah, he's still there, yeah.
So we didn't send him anything, you know, because we were dealing with stateside people.
Okay.
That comes up unfortunately from time to time, where some of the best are still away from here. Okay.
Paul would be really a good one to talk to because he's a black American.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. And
that's
we have
also
so
how
few,
his name came up.
Yeah, so few black Americans that we're able to get. He and who's the other guy? I think he still is around town here someplace. I can't remember his name now.
Well, there was another fellow in New York City, but unfortunately he arrived, his service was in Vietnam, and he arrived in October of 67, so he just got settled in, and then the Tet Offensive came along, and he, you know, had to serve in hospitals helping take care of wounded, and then they shipped him home.
Well, they shipped him home after that.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of sites were iffy.
I see.
At that point, and many people were probably not going to be resettled into a site until so far long into their service that it was better just to say, you know, we don't have anything for you.
Yeah.
So he did send in one of these yellow sheets, but unfortunately, with only about 6 or 7 months of service, most of it dealing with bedpans and bandages, why I decided in the crush of interviews that it would be nice to get his perspective on being a black American serving along with white Americans in Vietnam. But
well, this this black American that was with IVS would probably be a good contact because he felt there were some racial issues from time to time.
There probably were.
And he, last I heard, he works for USDA in Washington here.
Oh,
And I can't remember his name now. But he'd be a good person to talk to.
Well, hopefully it will, you know, the name will pop up as your subconscious searches through.
Okay.
And make a quick note of it. Let me pause again here. Just, I think I've gone through quite a bit. I mean, it's almost getting up to not an hour and a half yet, but we're getting on there. Before I started the tape, though, we talked about changing of life.
Yeah.
And a lot of people had that sort of experience, and to some extent, you mentioned a few of those things in your yellow sheet that you filled in, but if you could amplify, you know, some of the changes that you've...
Well, obviously the basic one is I no longer went back to work as an electrical engineer.
that is a big one.
Went back to school, got a fellowship at the East-West Center to get master's degree in kind of a behavioral science overlay to the engineering degree. And then that was to prepare myself for a career in international development rather than being an electrical engineer in military electronics back in the U.S. And after the graduate degree, worked for AID. And,
again, in Laos.
The rest is history, yeah. Went back to Laos.
Okay.
The funny thing was that the graduate degree wasn't necessarily the qualification that got me that job. They were looking for people with the technical degree and the Lao language to run a specific training program in Laos.
So you already had all the qualifications.
Right. But that got me in the door.
Yeah.
And just branched out from there into all kinds of other things. But again, Laos prepared me for working in a very complex country in a what they're calling complex humanitarian emergencies now in the last few years.
Okay.
With conflict going on and trying to do work effectively in a country which has conflict. And most of the places that I've worked have been more or less in that type of a situation, which prepared me for a senior job in AID in Washington running relief programs and becoming the aid rep in Bosnia to me was going to be a kind of a culmination of all these experiences. Unfortunately, our administration policies on Bosnia are very short-sighted. Wasn't able to do what I wanted to do for Bosnia, and so when I retired, I came here and here. Now, if you want to close the loop, loop, starting NGO, getting professional experience in the government, and coming back to an NGO.
Now World Vision trying to do...
Which might permit me to do some of the things that... at this point appears can only be done from the in a private organization or an external organization rather than inside the government. But again, in partnership with the government, we're going to see where this takes us.
What sort of things do you
conflict
do you mean?
Management, conflict resolution,
okay. All right.
Reconciliation. And this brings me back to, you know, all the time that I was in AID.
How many years was that?
28 years.
28. Oh,
right.
Okay.
The separation of church and state keeps you being working in a secular situation and your official duties.
Correct.
But the whole time that I was working overseas, I was always working closely also and good friends with the missionary community.
Yeah.
And doing what I could to be of assistance to them.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in Niger, we established the Gideons, the Gideons mm-hmm. organization for Niger, which is what, 97-98% Muslim, and we were able to establish a Gideons organization in Niger. Now, coming out of AID with all that experience, I'm working for a faith-based NGO,
uh-huh.
which will be able to combine in these situations we find ourselves where there's ethnic and religious conflict, combine the professional experience I've developed,
correct,
with the spiritual aspects of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that motivates these conflicts?
Correct.
The ethnic and religious motivations for conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
Work with a faith-based NGO to put that into the equation and see if we can't develop a true multidisciplinary approach mm-hmm. to conflict resolution. So this is...
That's quite an odyssey.
This is going to be an interesting experience here with,
yeah.
With World Vision.
So you haven't been with World Vision for that long, really?
Just 7 months.
7 months, okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you're really getting grounded and learning your way about, and now you're ready to start really doing things.
Yes. I was ready to start the moment I walked in the
well,
door.
I know, but I mean...
I have to bring an institution along with me. Of course, it's interesting that Andrew Natsios was my boss in AID.
Uh-huh. And he's here.
And he's here. So I found a fairly easy step from working in AID to World Vision,
mm-hmm.
because Andrew Natsios has the same kind of vision for World Vision that... That I'd like to participate in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's very fortunate.
Yeah, it is.
And no, I mean, I seriously mean that, because
yeah.
a lot of people just don't get those
yeah.
things working together.
No, I'm... And if everything works out right, what I wanted to do when I was in AID and not able to do because mm-hmm. of the myopia of the people there, we've got a proposal into AID to
uh-huh.
fund World Vision working in a consortium
uh-huh.
to do exactly what I wanted to do when I was in AID and couldn't do it. They're supposed to be giving me the answer this week whether they're going to fund it or not. But they say that they're going to give it, that they are going to fund it.
The
verbal
word
is
yeah,
that they are going to fund our activity.
Yeah, there's definitely a role to play. I mean, that's
yeah.
there is something of a parallel with IVS there.
And when I mentioned early in our conversation about IVS not being willing to grow, to
mm-hmm.
meet, to take advantage of the opportunities for NGOs that are
yeah, I forget that was probably before the tape was on, but
yeah. To me, I would have liked to have gone back to IVS had they expanded their portfolio
mm-hmm.
and their horizons and their vision. But finding an organization like World Vision, which until now has pretty much been satisfied to work only at a community level,
mm-hmm.
but wanting to expand to work at all levels, including at the national government levels, which is what it's going to take for conflict resolution. This is a very interesting challenge, because you have governments not doing what they should be doing. Does that mean that the NGOs and the private sector will step in and fill a role that needs to be taken now?
Mm-hmm.
Or does it mean that governments are going to be ashamed of themselves pretty soon and take on the role they should be taking? Or is there an effective partnership that will be developing here between governments and the private sector?
I think probably the third is much more likely. I think the second is absolutely impossible. And the first would probably be okay, but probably won't work, which leaves you by elimination down to the third.
And to be in an NGO now that wants to grow
to do this
in that direction is very interesting.
Well, good.
In one sense, once an NGO, always an NGO at heart.
Well, no, I've been impressed as I've gone through talking with former IVS folks and also knowing some former Peace Corps folks that collectively there's been a shifting of AID over time to be think more responsive than it was when it was first created. That the IVS and former IVS, former Peace Corps folks had a lot of influence.
Yeah.
A very positive benefit. That it may not make the perfect organization, you know. Okay, I can accept that. But I can remember some of the AID things that I saw when I was a volunteer in Peace Corps volunteer in the late 60s and say, that'll never work.
Right.
I mean, who the hell ever thought of that? I mean, I've got a couple wonderful stories about an AID guy. Who wanted to shift the Philippine dietary staple from rice to bread, and he was going to use coconuts and make a coconut flour.